Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
But thanks so much for coming down. To my far right, we have Emily Brady, author of Humboldt book, author of the book Humboldt. Please give her a warm round of applause. And to the middle is Bo Kilmer, co-director of the RAND Drug Policy Research Center and co-author of Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. Thank you, Bo.
Thanks, Dave.
And again, I'm David Downs. I'm the cannabis editor over at the San Francisco Chronicle now. The Chronicle has launched an exploration of cannabis called Green State, and that's available at greenstate.com, where we're reporting on the cannabis space with a spirit of adventurousness and empowerment and authenticity and worldliness. And it's journalism with a capital J, trained on the subject of a marijuana like never before. I'm also the author of the Medical Marijuana Guidebook, which is available for sale over there. It's a great guide for patients and caregivers who've asked me a lot of questions over the years as a cannabis journalist, tried to round up all the answers for them. So this is just a relaxed in conversation with, so we just get to chill out and talk a little bit about what's really interesting us and what might be interesting to you, the consumers. And my first, you know, conversation topic is for Emily. You went out to Humboldt, you researched, you wrote, you published this book, Humboldt. What did you learn about what's happening in the North Bay and even more rural Northern California, and why readers and attendees might care about their fate?
Two very big questions. So my book is about this community of people in Northern California that grow marijuana and have been growing it for 40, now almost 50 years. And I returned to the Bay Area a while back and was sort of fascinated by the kind of legalization movement. And I got to thinking, I knew there were these pot towns, and I'm from the North Bay. And for all of you guys maybe who don't know, it's probably Berkeley, so you do know, but there are these communities where, like, pretty much everybody is involved in marijuana cultivation in one way or another. And I went up there, and I went for a week, and I discovered that most of the law enforcement officers I was talking to were for legalization, and that many of the farmers I was talking to were against it. And I was like, this is really interesting. So I stayed and ended up living there for over a year and writing a book where I follow four people through their kind of lives, and they represent different parts of different kind of aspects of the community. I followed like an old time grower who was like very righteous and wanted marijuana to be legal. I followed like a young man who worked for somebody who was a very industrial black market grower. And then there was a sheriff, and then a girl who grew up with parents who were growers. And I thought it was just super interesting from like a sociological aspect that there was this kind of culture that grew up around this, and that people were really scared about marijuana going mainstream, and that their whole economy was going to crash. And that was basically the fear, because in a way these were like the last small farmers, like healthy, smart farmers that earned like a good living from their crop because it was illegal and the prices were pretty high. What was the second part of your question?
Why should people care about what happens to them, those farmers?
And that's a good question. And I don't know what I'm finding. I think if you care about how your food is grown and you consume marijuana, I think it's good to care about how it's grown. In general, I mean, what I'm finding is I think people don't care that much about the small farmers of Humboldt County, and I think their culture is dying as legalization happens, and the small farmer, we can talk about that more, is really struggling to find a place in the legalization landscape. But I don't know, I think it's a really personal thing for everybody. I guess if you care about small farmers and you care about people finding a way to like have a livelihood in the countryside, then you'd care. But if you don't, you know.
Do you guys care what happens to Humboldt small farmers? Raise your hand if you care. All right, so I think Berkeley cares.
Yeah.
What do you think is going to happen to them?
I mean, So I wrote my book, I think my book ends in like 2012 or 2013, and it basically predicted everything that's happening now. What is happening is that the small farmers are having a really hard time transitioning to legal. You have the old timers who are probably like my favorite like generation of growers, or the people who came, a lot of them came from Berkeley or San Francisco, and just kind of were back to the landers, and they happened upon marijuana growing as like an accident, and it ended up being this lucrative way to kind of stay in the countryside. They are all like cashing out. They're selling their land and they're retiring because they're older. They're in their like 70s, and it's hard to be old and live up a dirt road in the middle of nowhere. And also they have no way, like access to markets is really hard. There's all this pressure on them to, like there's codes, there's a pathway to legalization, but it's very expensive. And when you live up a dirt road, now there's like, is that dirt road running into the creek at all? Is if you have employees, which most people do, or there is your little funky homestead like up to Cal OSHA standards? Like these things, so if you're like a big industrial grower and you've got a lot of money, you can like get up to code and it's worth it. And if you don't, it's really hard. So a lot of them are retiring. Or they're saying, like a friend of mine, here's a guy who's a friend of mine, he had like a nursery where he'd sell bamboo in Humboldt, and then he'd like grew pot on the side, but now he's actually doing well because his nursery is now selling pot plants to people.
Okay.
So he's doing well. Another friend is just like, it's not ours anymore and is retired. So you've got a lot of people, and it's getting much more industrial.
Bo, I imagine you have a lot of experience at the Drug Policy Research Center looking at the potential industrialization of cannabis and might be able to fill in these readers on some of these economics and what's happening up there. Does what Emily's saying resonate with you or make sense to you?
Oh, definitely. So, you know, as David mentioned, I work at the RAND Corporation. We're headquartered down in Santa Monica. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank. And I co-direct our Drug Policy Research Center, where we do work in a lot of different areas related to substance use and drug policy. We don't have an official position on cannabis. But, you know, the conversation started to get pretty serious about this right around 2009, 2010. That's when legislation was introduced here in California, and there were also discussions about there being a ballot initiative focused on legalization. And it was at that point you begin to see folks on kind of both sides of this issue just kind of really talking past each other and using these really big numbers that would kind of hijack the debates. I mean, you would hear claims that California was spending $2 billion enforcing cannabis prohibition within the state. Turns out the true figure is about $200 million. Which still is a fair amount of money, but that's an order of magnitude difference. And so with a few of my colleagues in kind of early 2010, what we try to do is we try to put together this report, trying to help the voters understand, here are the numbers you should believe, here are the numbers you shouldn't believe. And we also took a shot at trying to project what would happen if California were to legalize. You know, and with this all being illegal under federal law, we really didn't know what the federal government was going to do. So we started kind of building some of these elaborate models, and the bottom line is so much depends on what's going to happen to the retail price. For a lot of the outcomes that people care about, you know, the size of the illicit market, what happens to consumption, tax revenues, that all depends on what happens to the retail price. And for a number of reasons, we would expect that after legalization, that you'd see the transportation and the distribution and the production costs go down dramatically. Because most importantly, you're getting rid of the risk, right? When someone right now, when you purchase marijuana or heroin or methamphetamine, a lot of what you're doing is compensating the drug dealers and everyone else along the supply chain for the risk of arrest and risk of incarceration. You legalize, that goes away. Also, if you allow big industrial grows, you get economies of scale that pushes those costs down, changes in technology. And so, I mean, so we would expect that over time, and we're even seeing this in Washington and Colorado and in California now, you're seeing these the wholesale prices going down quite a bit. Now, of course, one of the claims is well, we can always kind of put taxes on it to try to, if we want to kind of keep the prices inflated. But still, we would expect that, I mean, especially once California comes on board in 2018 with recreational and other states, you're going to continue to see those production and distribution costs go down quite a bit. And I can remember, so when this report came out in 2010, Before then, not a lot of people were talking about price and legalization debates.
Yeah.
And I remember people saying, oh, what do these RAND nerds know about growing cannabis? And being very critical of what we were talking about. But as Emily talks about in her book, at the same time that we were doing this research, trying to show, and we were talking to farmers, legal and illegal farmers, trying to get ideas about what the prices could be. Emily was, as she mentioned in her book, they were having the same discussions up in Humboldt. They knew. There's a reason why the Emerald Triangle all voted against Proposition 19 in 2010. And that's because they knew how much money that they were going to lose.
Let's put a real dollar value on this. At the peak, cannabis would retail for $20 a gram for high-quality OG Kush. I remember paying that in Isla Vista as a black market college buyer in 1998. And it seemed to have gone down ever since. How steep of a decrease are we talking about if we assume that we hit full industrialization and legalization?
Well, a lot's going to depend on what happens with the federal government. If the federal government legalizes, the thing to keep in mind is a colleague of mine had estimated that if you were trying to grow enough cannabis to produce all the THC, that's the intoxicating cannabinoid in cannabis, if you wanted to produce enough cannabis to get that much, to get all the THC that's consumed in the United States, you could probably do that on a couple dozen farms in Iowa.
Yeah.
It does not take a lot of space. And so at that point, if you have big industrial grows, you could see the production distribution costs going well, well below a dollar. But that's going to take time.
From $20 a gram to a dollar a gram.
Can I interject for a sec? To talk in growers' terms where everything is in pounds. Like in the 80s when it was like full-on war on drugs, Reagan cracking down, say no. I knew people who got $5,000 a pound for their marijuana. Those same people today are getting about $900.
$900 a pound. Yeah. And then think how much tomatoes cost a pound.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so the thing to keep in mind, though, is so even though with legalization you're going to push those production distribution costs down, a lot's going to depend on what the taxes are.
Sure.
And the bottom line is nobody knows the best way to tax cannabis. There are lots of different ways to do it, but one of the issues is if you tax it too much, there's still going to be an illicit market. Most of the discussion that's happening here in the States is focused on an ad valorem tax, price per gram. Or 15%.
Receipts tax usually.
Yeah. Percent.
Just like sales tax.
Yeah, it's very easy. But there are a couple things to keep in mind. There are advantages and disadvantages with all these different kind of tax regimes. The advantages of taxing as a function of price is it's easy to collect. In Washington State, it's 37% at the retail level. In Oregon, I think it's now at 17%, but then the localities can add some on. And so the advantage is it's easy to collect. People understand that. There are a couple potential disadvantages. One, if you're not smart about how you design the tax, there could be bundling where, I'll sell you this pipe for $30 and give you the weed for free. So you have to be smart about that. But then the other thing is if your tax is a function of the price and the prices continue to go down, the amount of revenue coming in is going to go down. So this is one of the things, so you now have a lot of corporate interests and you've got these different kind of corporate consultants trying to project what the tax revenues are going to be through 2025. When you see those, you got to take those with several grains of salt because you have to kind of build in that the prices are going to continue to go down quite a bit.
Is this a story of an industry meeting industrialization, a story that played out in California for every other agricultural sector 70, 80 years ago?
It could be.
How can it not be? That seems to be our model of growing. And before this legalization measure passed, everybody in Humboldt used to be scared, like when legalization comes, they're going to be growing, acres of weed in the Central Valley. And like there were like the conspiracy theorists were like Philip Morris and Marlboro are going to get in on it. But what we're seeing is that like they're growing acres of weed in Salinas and that, the venture-backed businesses are buying these old flower growing warehouses and growing like massive grows. Steve D'Angelo of Harborside has like a 47-acre farm. And what's really interesting, this is just a geeky little like parentheses of like the drug war, but these flower greenhouses were wiped out. In like 1991, the U.S. signed a trade pact with Colombia to try and convince Colombian farmers to stop growing coca and to start growing flowers. So they like killed the tax on flowers for imports. So now, I don't know, like 70% of our flowers come from Colombia, and they wiped out the Salinas flower growing industry, and now they're going to be growing cannabis in the warehouses.
Wow, wow.
Full circle.
It strikes me that that Salinas area is also synonymous with John Steinbeck and
right.
the Grapes of Wrath, which was another story about industrialization and people getting kicked off their land because they couldn't afford to make enough marginal profit to pay their debts. I mean, that's the story of the Joads, is they had to leave, as an example of all these farmers who, when faced with price crashes, the economies collapse and sent them migrating west to what became California, where they encountered a lot of the same exploitation that they were dealing with over in the Midwest. Now that whole cycle's playing out again in the same place. Yeah.
It's a story for you.
Yeah.
So Humboldt is kind of like the story of the Joads before they have to leave, like the storm clouds gathering for them almost.
Humboldt's like the woman I write about in my book that I call Mare. She's like, she calls them the marijuana moonshiners. And basically these are people who basically kind of kept the marijuana industry going and grew marijuana for a good part of the country for the last, I don't know, 4 to 5 decades. And yeah, those are, I mean, I think when the dust settles, I mean, change is happening and change is hard. And I think people are being squeezed out. And when the dust settles, there will be very few people growing marijuana in very big quantities in Humboldt.
Your book was published a number of years ago. Do you stay in touch with your subjects? Do you hear from them or follow them? Or
so there were 4 subjects, and I stay in touch with 2 of them. I've kind of fallen out of touch with the other 2.
The sheriff
I stay in touch with, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, we're Facebook friends, and he retired and lives part of the year in Italy, and he's doing really good. And
he's not starting a pot farm, is he?
No, he's not. That would not be his path. But he was pro-legalization, but very fed up with growing. And then there was a character called Emma World Peace, who was born in the community and, you know, sort of told the story of what it's like to grow up with, like, not being able to say what your parents do for a living and having your mom get busted and this kind of stuff. And she is a social worker in Chico and just recently became a mom. And the 2 growers I have, unfortunately, I'm no longer in touch with. I should look them up. I think I'm still friends with one of them on Facebook, but yeah.
It's really interesting in your book to realize that there's a lot of kids growing up back there behind the redwood curtain, back in these hills, in this culture. What did you learn about what this culture does to kids? Is it good for them? Is it bad for them? Second question, should this all be happening on a farm in Fresno and not with these families back there?
I think that's a great question, and I think that the actual, like, growing up with parents who are farmers in a beautiful place there's nothing wrong with that, and it's actually it's such a stunningly beautiful place. If anybody has not been to Humboldt, I highly recommend it. Anyway, I think it's a great place to grow up. I think what is oppressive and what was ultimately really detrimental to a lot of the youth in the culture was this, like, cloak of secrecy. Like, they were not allowed to talk about what their parents did. And especially in the 80s when the pot prices were so high, it was like the risk was your parents could go to jail. So it was even like your best friend whose parents were probably growers too. Like you weren't able to talk about it. And I think that's really toxic. And this one young man I met at a party up there said, like, I felt like I was born criminal. And there's a real, like, insular kind of vibe to the young people. And I think another thing I was always fascinated by was, like, I think every generation likes to rebel against their parents, but, like, how do you rebel against parents who are, like, have really lax norms and grow pot plants and live in the middle of nowhere?
Do you go to Harvard and become a stockbroker?
There may have been one of those. I didn't hear about that. Usually it's like you become kind of like, I'm trying to find a decent way to say this, like, you become kind of like a hardcore, like, redneck pot grower, and you get, like, a really big truck, and, like, you kind of, like, you know, you grow, like, a ton of pot, like, really not environmentally in a good way, like you become really materialist and you...
So they don't go straight edge. They don't go straight edge. They go pure capitalist.
They go pure capitalist, pure capitalist outlaw.
Because their parents were kind of crunchy, more communist-y, socialist-y, environmental.
Yeah, and the parents usually grew like a small amount, and they'd go like to Mexico in the winter and like stay in like a little funky house, and it was just like kind of to keep up a kind of a counterculture lifestyle where the kids are like, wow, these are like money trees, and I can make a ton of money and buy a big truck and buy fancy jeans and buy fake boobs for my girlfriend, and like there's this whole other layer of it that's really interesting.
When you think back upon the book and you think of all the research you did, and now you like go out and do parties or you talk about the book, what colorful stories from Humboldt will always stick with you? How did it change you as a person?
My God, that's a really good question. How did it change me as a person? I think living up there, I was living in New York City before. I'm from the North Bay, and I was living in New York City, and I moved back there, and I think it really reconnected me to the like natural beauty of California.
Yeah.
And I'm really grateful for that. And I actually made some really great friends up there. Not anybody that I wrote about, but I made some great friends and like some older growers, like kind of older hippie mama ladies that I just really love and I've really learned a lot from. And I'm grateful for. I think...
Were you ever in personal danger during your year up there?
I don't think so, no. I saw one gun, and it was Crockett, one of the characters in my books, had it because he was like saying he would defend his grow if anybody came to rip him off. But he, you know, he didn't point it at me, and I ended up actually smoking a little weed with him, and then we drove out in his little quad, like four-wheeler, to kind of see his grow, and I actually had like a little bit of a paranoid trip because I was like, saw the gun, and I was like, oh my God, what if somebody comes and like wants to rip us off, and like, do I run into the woods, and you know, what if there's bears there, and he was just like, chill out. and nobody came, and everything was fine, but that was probably like my little thing of paranoia. I think really what I took away from it is like, my God, there are interesting subcultures and interesting communities among us. Like, what a rich and, like, interesting country we are. Like, just 4 hours up the road, there's this fully insular community that had its own, like, mores. And, like, they would give out, like, the school would give out pot plants for people to sell, to, like, harvest, to, like, raise money for the school. And, like, the fire department, like, it was just, like, this kind of...
nodding, like, yep, that's how they do it out there.
Yeah. I mean, it was just, it's interesting.
So instead of a bake sale, it's a real bake sale. Sorry, that one's right there.
Yeah, kind of like that.
Yeah. Speaking of mores... In last year, Reveal, which was like part of the Center for Investigative Reporting, did a pretty big story about employment or employees' workplace rights out in the hills, and detailed a really chilling story about a case of sexual assault that occurred out there and the community code in essential conflict between its desire for secrecy and protecting its own and yet the need to police sort of bad actors. How is that community treating its women, in your opinion, and its women workers? And what did you learn about women's rights and workers' rights up there?
I think in general, people treat their workers really good. I read that story and I thought it was excellent. I wasn't surprised. I think in general, people treat their workers really, really well because their workers come and live with them and they feed them and the workers like manicure the marijuana, kind of help process it for sale. And it's like a huge part of the harvest. So in general, they treat them really well. But I think you have so many different kinds of people and you have so many people moving there just to straight make a profit and they don't care about the environment and they don't care about the community schools and they don't, you know, they're just there for like pure hardcore capitalist reasons. And, you know, you have this industry where it's all trust and handshakes and, you know, it's unregulated. And so there are no protection for workers. So if you're some weird person out in the middle of nowhere, you can hire some people and you can abuse them. And there's no real like checks and balances. Like the old first generation like humble growers like have a code, and like they were known for kicking people out of their community who violated their laws environmentally and or you know abused their kids, because these are all things, abused their wives, these are all things people would, you couldn't really go to the cops, because if the cops drive up the road and they see the neighbors growing, it was it's a very insular culture, but they had a way of dealing with it on their own.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's like frontier justice in 2012.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess I don't know if there's a way to answer this question, but like, how do you preserve the good parts of that and work on the bad parts at the same time? Have you thought about disentangling the sort of parts of the culture to keep and the parts of the culture that need to get jettisoned in Humboldt and the Emerald Triangle? And is that even possible?
I don't know. I mean, there's good and bad in all of us. And I think what is clear to me is that, you know, I'm for legalization. And I think that this whole culture and this whole way of life sprung up around something that was like kind of wrong, which was that it was illegal. And now that it's going legal, it's you know, things are changing and there's going to be laws and rules. And I don't think the culture as it was, it will survive. It'll be something else.
Do you think it's going to become like a like consumer experience replica culture instead of the authentic one? I think of how you can still go pan for gold in Gold Country and visit Sutter's Mill and or all these other sort of tourist attraction versions of a way life used to be in an area. Do you think that's what's coming for Humboldt, is the consumer experience versus...
There was talk, the first like kind of public talk about marijuana happened in 2010. It was called What's After Pot, and it was right before, it was kind of when the first legalization measure was on the ballot, and people were like, oh my God, this is coming. And there was talk of like having marijuaneries and bud and breakfasts, you know, and places.
What was the first one?
Marijuaneries, you know, like wineries, marijuaneries.
Okay.
That was the term. There's
marijuana.
A desperate need for good branding and good marketing in the marijuana industry. But I think there are some entrepreneurial minds. It'd be great to see something like that, but I don't know if it'll get like really sophisticated. I mean, a lot of these are like little mom and pop operations, and yeah.
But just to follow on,
yeah.
With that, I mean, that's one of the interesting things about Proposition 64, which passed in November. It's different from Colorado and Washington, and that was, so Colorado, Washington, and Oregon, and Alaska had legalized in either 2014 or 2012, and there they didn't allow for on-premises consumption.
Yeah.
So that is, I mean, you could go into a store and buy it, but you couldn't necessarily go into like a coffee shop and stay there and consume.
And it's a huge problem. There's nowhere to use it in these legal
states. Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting in Colorado where, you know, you've got tourists coming in and they have no place to use it. And then the hotels will then, you know, fine you $400 or $500 for smoking in the room. And some of them see that as a cost of doing business. The hotels make money. People are able to consume. But it also means that you have a lot more people then who are, tourists coming in using edibles, who may not necessarily know how to use edibles, and
And then they overdo it.
They'll overdo it. Oh, well, it's been 30 minutes. I don't feel anything.
Dosage with edibles is always, questionable.
Yeah, so it'll be really interesting when they start giving out the licenses in early 2018 here in California. I mean, local jurisdictions are going to be able to make decisions about whether or not they want to allow kind of coffee shops. I mean, you're not going to be able to go into a bar and buy alcohol and marijuana. If you can't get one of the cannabis licenses if you have an alcohol or a tobacco license. You'll be walking down the street. Some people will go to this place and get their wine and gin and tonics. Other people go across the street. And it'll be interesting to see how it plays out with indoor clean air laws. I mean, my guess is that you might be able to vape. There are places in the Bay Area where you can consume indoors already. But this is going to be very different. Anyone can come in off the street who's 21 and older. So it'll be interesting to see if, like, maybe inside you can only vape, eat edibles, and who knows if they're going to have picnic areas, picnic tables where you can kind of smoke outside. And so that's going to be very different from kind of what we're seeing in the other places. So.
Yeah, I was just at this in Santa Rosa at the Sonoma County Fairgrounds for the High Times U.S. Cannabis Cup NorCal, which is part of their regional series because they take it all around the country
branding.
Now. And it struck me that this massive 215 area, which is the smoking area where you can consume cannabis products on the premise of the fairgrounds, It's gated off from the rest, and you need a wristband to get in, and you get that wristband by showing the staff your medical marijuana recommendation, and then you're allowed into what's essentially the other half of the venue. These 215 areas used to be just a tiny little fraction, and I think after legalization, it's very telling to see that they're half the event, and pretty soon might be all of the event, except for the fact that when you look at Colorado and you look at Washington, they have not authorized sales outside of the brick and mortar dispensary where the licensee has a license to sell marijuana. So all the giveaway or all the sales you're seeing at the Cup this weekend are kind of in up in the air going forward. I mean, we're talking millions of dollars of commerce in over 2 days. If you think of 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 people there spending $100, $200, $300 on flowers, extracts, edibles, clones, it adds up. And so I don't know if anybody there realizes that that experience is in jeopardy or they care. And then on the other side, just the public consumption aspect of it. Again, Washington, Colorado, Oregon, no one's carved out social use laws to allow for getting together, assembling and using cannabis together. But everyone's just kind of like shrugging and the good times are rolling this weekend. Can you think of other aspects of today's market that are going to look might look totally different in a year or two? Are you been thinking about this at all?
Yeah, I mean, just the proliferation of products.
Okay, yeah.
It's just been fascinating.
There is a million and one products in every tossable formulation you can imagine. And this cup might be the peak in terms of what I found out there. You wouldn't believe the... I got a bag in my car. I won't tell you where the car is, but there's so... I saw this guy... they are doing pouches of coconut oil that are infused, and it's like a tear-off pouch, and inside is coconut oil that's got an infusion. You can put it on your skin. You could put it in your coffee. You could... Some people are putting it into their hair. I asked why. They're like, I don't know. And then you could use it as a sexual lube. It was out of control. But there's edible rules about caffeine and dairy that are coming up. And so go on products.
So right now in California legalized medical in 1996, and but it wasn't regulated at the state level until laws passed in 2015. So you now have had a number of state agencies kind of developing a new regulatory system on the medical side. While they're in the process of doing that, now then all of a sudden, you know, Prop 64 passes. So now they're in the process of kind of developing those regulations as well. And so it's going to be up to these. So on one hand, you know, they're going to be developing these regulations in terms of what can be allowed and what can't be allowed. I don't think they're going to necessarily... There have been discussions about limiting THC levels. But in terms of how, you know, molds and pesticides, what's going to be allowed, what's not going to be allowed. So part of those, some of those decisions, I think, are going to be made at the state level in Sacramento. But it's also going to be up to the local jurisdictions. You know, one can imagine, you know, some jurisdictions saying, you know what?
No candy.
We want to stay away from the candy, maybe some of the high potency flower. So we'll give you a business license, but only if you're selling flower less than 20% THC. That's an option. That's an option that the local governments have. And the other thing to keep in mind, as I mentioned before, is this is still all illegal under federal law. And I mean, the bottom line is you should be skeptical of anyone who claims that they know what the Trump administration is going to do about cannabis. Lots of mixed messages. We don't know, but we do know that AG Sessions, who's not a fan of marijuana, has kind of put together this task force that's focusing on different issues surrounding violence and public safety. And he's got a subcommittee focused on cannabis policy. So I think this task force is supposed to release some recommendations. I'm not sure if they're going to be public at the end of July. But I mean, one of the things that... No, I don't. I mean, I think this is within the Department of Justice, and I don't know who they're talking to.
I do. The head of it is a guy named Steve Cook, and he is really big figure in the Association of Assistant U.S. Attorneys in the country, which has been written about and known for being really hardline about all criminal justice issues. So while America's been talking about, you know, stepping back from mandatory minimums, the Association of Assistant U.S. Attorneys have said, no, we love them more, please. Because in America, something like 90, 95% of cases don't go to trial because the ends in please, because the mandatory minimums are often so onerous that the fear of getting sentenced to a mandatory minimum is enough for 90% of defendants to plead out rather than face trial, which isn't necessarily mean justice is being done. If you are not going to trial and you're innocent and you plead guilty because you'd rather do 5 years than life, it's hard to say how justice has been done in those circumstances. So Steve Cook is running the task force, and he's from Tennessee, from Knoxville. They don't have a great record on cannabis law reform, and he's said a lot of things over the years that have made Jeff Sessions a fan of him in terms of drugs automatically equaling violence and the number one solution for America being prison time, lengthy prison time for anyone they deem to be criminals, quote unquote, and drug users to them are criminals. So
I guess just adding on to that, and so even when this report comes out and recommendations are made, you know, so much of what's going to happen at the federal level really depends on not necessarily just the attorney general, but also the U.S. attorneys. So we have, 93 or 94 U.S. attorneys all throughout the United States, and they're the ones that have the discretion. They can decide whether or not they want to go for marijuana or deal with something else. And last I heard, they still hadn't appointed any of the U.S. attorneys. So,
for California?
No. So you've got acting.
You've got
acting U.S. attorneys.
So Wagner.
Yeah. So you had the ones that were nominated through the Obama administration. I think most of them have left.
Okay.
So now you have acting U.S. attorneys, but
okay.
They still haven't selected. The Trump administration still hasn't selected the 93, or I think it's 93 U.S. attorneys. And so the preferences for those individuals is going to shape a lot.
And I just want to add something to the federal. As long as marijuana is illegal federally, there will still be a black market, and that you're still going to have these massive grows on, you know, public and private land that you read about, and the clear cutting and like the environmental stuff, because it's still worth a lot of money. And the majority of cannabis grown in California is exported on the black market out of the state.
I mean, that's the big question.
Yeah,
I mean, when we think about legalization, you're not going to eliminate,
state legalization.
State legalization. You're not going to eliminate law enforcement efforts. You're not going to kind of zero out their spending and dealing with cannabis enforcement. So one of the big questions is what's going to happen up north? You know, there are going to be some of these people who are growing right now who are going to try to get licenses and try to be part of the legal market. What's going to happen to those who choose not to be part of the legal market and who are exporting out of the state? Are we going to kind of turn a blind eye to this? Or are they, are there going to be stepped up efforts to increase enforcement? And so this is one area you can imagine the federal government maybe getting involved in.
Yeah. Have you heard any of your contacts in the Emerald Triangle celebrate the rise of Trump and Sessions and a hard line and essentially an extension of prohibition and essentially an extension of their price floor?
Nobody that I know would be along those lines, but I have no doubt that there are people who think that.
Yeah, just doing a little heel kick every time Sessions does another press conference.
The more you crack down on it, the higher the price will go, right?
Well, I think a salient question might be, how long does the black market have in terms of a time range from forever, because we have prohibition forever, and so the black market exists forever. How fast, if we just turned up the dial to 10 on legalization, could we eradicate the black market in California and America? A decade? A generation? 50 years? We've had the black market for pot for 80 years now. 80 years?
Oh, if you had federal legalization?
If you have federal
legalization, as I said, I mean, it may be the case that California isn't the ideal place to grow, given in terms of transportation and distribution. Like I said, maybe it's Iowa, maybe it's New Mexico.
You mentioned those farms in Iowa. You could do it all on six farms.
Yeah, you could do this all in other places. And so, I mean, there's always going to be demand for kind of, organic, hand-cut, artisanal buds. I mean, yeah, artisanal buds. So there's always going to be some type of market for that. And the Humboldt brand means something. If you were to have federal legalization, I'm guessing within at least, no more than 20 years.
Right.
But a lot's going to depend on, but there are trade-offs with this, right? And so this is where I think reasonable people can disagree when it comes to dealing with cannabis policy. You know, for some people, their goal is they want to, you know, they want to get rid of the illicit market as quickly as possible. If that's your goal, you allow a lot of production, you don't have a lot
flood
of regulation,
the market with cheap
flood
stuff,
the market, push
get
the
all
price
the mar-
down.
All the people on Nabisco
exactly,
weed.
Yeah. You talk to folks on the public health side, they're a bit skeptical.
They like the high prices.
The high prices, and especially
for
yeah,
legal.
And especially because most of the research that's been done on both the health benefits and the health risks associated with cannabis is largely focused on people who were smoking lower potency cannabis in the 80s and 90s. Hmm. So a lot of these products, I mean, the stuff that's 20, you know, flower that's 20% THC, waxes that are 65, 70, 75% THC, we haven't been doing the studies. We don't have the information on the health consequences. So that's why I can understand why some risk-averse jurisdictions may say, you know what, early on we may not allow some of these higher potency products. And so there's a tension there, and that's why I said so much comes down to what happens to price.
Speaking of studying then versus now, one thing you've worked on over the years is the issue of alcohol substitution. Can you tell me why that's been such a salient issue to you and what you've seen data points come in after legalization to update your opinions one way or the other? The idea of alcohol substitution is when pot's legal, you might choose cannabis instead of alcohol, but we don't know if people might do that. Go.
Yeah, I mean, so if you're looking at this from a public health perspective, of course, you want to pay attention to what's going to happen to cannabis consumption, especially amongst youth. You do worry about there being an increase in the number of people who suffer from cannabis use disorders. So you want to pay attention to that, and we're going, as researchers, we are. But if you're going to be objective, you also have to pay attention to, well, how does cannabis legalization influence the use of alcohol, tobacco, and also prescription opioids? You want to be...
These are big public health
burdens. Yeah, so you want to look at all of that. And so I did some work right before, so for 2015 for the state of Vermont. You know, Vermont kind of saw the writing on the wall. You know, a very progressive place, you know, high rates of marijuana use.
Almost legalized it.
Almost, yeah. So the governor, a couple of years ago, wanted some work done to help them kind of think through these issues. So I reached out to them and said, hey, but RAND will help you kind of, RAND's not going to come out and say you should do X, Y, or Z, but what we can do is we can talk about all the different options that are out there and discuss, hey, here are the pros and cons. And so we ended up, a lot of those insights are in the book, but it's kind of a separate 200-page report for them. And as part of that, we kind of reviewed all of the literature. What happens, you know, when cannabis use goes up, what happens to alcohol consumption? We did that for tobacco and opioids as well. And, you know, so this is before legalization. With respect to alcohol, the research, it was largely split right down the middle.
It's like a wash, right?
Like a wash, yeah. I mean,
so like some people stop using alcohol, other people use more.
Yeah, what that means is people on both sides, because I've got all these peer-reviewed, you know, studies which show that they are substitute, that when you legalize cannabis, you're going to reduce reduce alcohol consumption. Then you got people on the other side say, no, when you legalize, you're going to increase cannabis consumption, and you'll also increase alcohol consumption. And so as a researcher, this is something we're paying really close attention to, and this matters a lot also with respect to impaired driving, which is one of the most controversial issues when you talk to anyone about this. I mean, the bottom line is that the bulk of the research suggests that driving drunk is worse than driving stoned. But driving stoned is still worse than driving sober. And the thing that you really worry about if you care about impaired driving is people being under the influence of both alcohol and cannabis at the same time.
Which is why Cornerstone's probably not going to sell weed anytime soon.
Yeah. But those are the things we're going to be paying attention to, but not just alcohol, but also really this issue with prescription opioids, because there is an increasing amount of research suggesting that states that have passed medical marijuana laws, that they've seen a reduction in opioid overdoses. I mean, you see the studies keep coming out in really good journals, and I've got colleagues that got studies which are arguably better that are going to be coming out soon and suggesting that they may be substitutes.
Is there something there?
Oh, I definitely think, I mean, the bulk of the, I mean, given, I mean, we're talking about Journal American Medical Association, Health Affairs. I mean, these are really good studies. I'm aware of one study which was published which didn't find an effect. But with the medical marijuana laws and the studies, you got to be a little bit skeptical because especially when you talk to people outside of California or outside of the United States, when you talk about medical marijuana, they think of California. Oh, you got dispensaries all over the place.
It's really easy to get.
But that's not how it is in all parts of the country. I mean, 28, 29 states now make allowances. for medical cannabis. And they, in some states, are much more strict in terms of what conditions you can get it for. And so, it's difficult because a lot of times what researchers have been doing is they've been saying, okay, you're either a medical marijuana state or you're not a medical marijuana state. So essentially then lumping California in with New York, where they have very different medical marijuana policies. So you have to be skeptical of some of that research. But I'd say, but there have been some better studies coming out suggesting that you are beginning to see the substitution. It's not entirely clear why. I mean, it might be the case that you have people who are real medical patients who just were using a lot of opioids who've now decided to substitute or maybe not use as many opioids and just using, you know, cannabis for medical purposes. Or it could also just be a black market story in some of the places where you've got medical marijuana laws. It's just, it's a lot easier and it's cheaper to get access to medical marijuana, so people are more likely to use that than try to get the prescription opioids on the black market. Can be really expensive, and that's one of the reasons why you've seen this uptick in heroin consumption. It gets to the point where people can no longer afford this. Heroin is cheap.
What is the way forward on driving? You mentioned it's a big issue. The police have certainly made a big issue out of it. You've reviewed the research. It sounds like driving stoned is as dangerous as driving with a passenger or driving pregnant in terms of the crash risk. There's a number of states that have per se laws that are like blood alcohol content. So with blood alcohol, you blow a .08 and you're going to jail. You're convicted. There's no, but I was fine, I felt fine argument. With cannabis, generally there isn't, especially in California. Some states have erected what's called a per se law, which says that if you have 5 nanograms or 8 nanograms of active THC per milliliter of blood drawn, that's convicted, just like alcohol. We don't care how sober you say you were. Other states have said that's a permissible inference, which means you can use that data in court, but it doesn't necessarily mean anything. And here in California, the police are tearing their hair out because the data doesn't really mean anything. The defense attorneys can go in and say, this guy smokes every day. He was fine when you pulled him over. You pulled him over for a broken taillight. He wasn't high. There's clearly a lot of push to come up with a per se law for driving. What should be policy best practices for states?
I mean, at this time, yeah, there isn't an evidence base on per se law. And so, I mean, there's a reason why that wasn't part of Proposition 64.
It's amazing that that science managed to catch on.
Yeah.
And people realize that that's even...
Yeah, I mean, because the thing is, THC and its metabolites can stay in your system for quite some time. So you can smoke on Friday, be fine on Monday, and for some people, it'll still be in your system. But I was reading this really interesting article in Scientific American by this guy, David Downs. And it was focused on this technology that some researchers at Stanford had come up with, some type of breathalyzer.
It's called the Hound. It's here in Berkeley.
Oh, is it in Berkeley? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so the thing is it's, I'll let David speak about it since he talked to the researchers there. But the bottom line is that you've got a lot of technology companies that are trying to figure this out. So my guess is that within 10 years, there might be some type of technological way of dealing with this. I mean, right now, the best you can do is with some of this, you can't figure out whether or not someone is intoxicated at the time, but what you can do, I mean, you can by looking at them, but one thing you can do is with some of the saliva tests and some of the sweat tests, you can at least figure out whether or not they've consumed within the past couple of hours. So you don't necessarily run into that issue of people using on the weekend and then, you know, getting caught on Monday or Tuesday. And so, I mean, I think there's some things you could do with that. In the interim, while, I mean, I think eventually there will be some technological fix. But to the extent that we care about, if we're really concerned about people driving under the influence of both alcohol and cannabis, I mean, one of the things you could do is, a colleague of mine had suggested that, if you're impaired and you get pulled over, if they're able to detect any cannabis and you have any alcohol in your system, there could be extra penalties there. So there are ways you can maybe kind of develop systems to at least try to really discourage people from using both alcohol and cannabis and driving.
So target the crossfaders, the people that are doing both.
That could be one approach.
Take them out.
Yeah, and then that's what's going to be interesting here. As I said, with jurisdictions in California making allowances for on-premises consumption. So it might be the case that some people, they would go to a normal bar and drink a lot of beer. Now they may just actually go to the cannabis lounge and kind of do that. And then maybe so they drive stoned as opposed to driving drunk. But it'll be interesting to see, well, are people going to maybe start by, you know, spending a lot of time at the bar, drinking alcohol, and then maybe go across the street and go to the cannabis lounge? And so from a public health perspective,
I feel like that would make me puke.
Yeah. I think for some people it would. And so so from a research perspective, that's one of the things. So actually, I just submitted a grant to begin trying to look at that. Because I think from a public health perspective, that's going to be an important piece. And to be honest, I don't know how it's going to play out. I can see a scenario where impaired driving gets worse. You can also potentially see a scenario where impaired driving may actually go down.
Haven't we seen early data saying you make pot available, these young guys who get drunk and drive on the weekends do it less because they're at home on the couch smoking weed instead?
You have seen it within the... So there have been some studies on the medical marijuana side.
Yeah.
So studies, yes, which have
By
suggested that.
By Kamen and Rees, I believe.
Yeah. But it's not like it's a big literature.
Yeah.
So...
I know Magnolia Wellness, the dispensary in Oakland, has... going through the process of getting their lounge fully permitted. Yeah. And they've had to go back and forth with the city around, well, what are you going to do when someone gets too high? Are you going to let them get in a car? Are you going to, you know, call them a Lyft? You need to have an articulated, written down sort of safety plan for people you are giving THC. And so what they've been doing at Magnolia has been copying from the alcohol literature. And it was very shocking to learn how drunk you can get at a bar, and the bar is legally allowed to just let you stagger off into the night. It's written down some like guidelines for screening people and cutting them off for alcohol.
Yeah.
And it's like, unless you need a cot, like a bed, you're allowed, if you can walk out of the bar under your own power, the bar is not at all liable for what you do when you leave. And yet we might have analogous standards, or in the case of Magnolia, higher standards of safety for these lounges. Because certainly they're making the rules for the first time.
Yeah.
They have less lobbyists to fight against.
Yeah.
And so you could theoretically construct a regime that's safer than what we have for alcohol now. I personally was terrified to learn how drunk you can get at a bar and legally the bartender can let you go.
Yeah.
I think a question these people might have, I certainly get it as a reader, is are stores and recreational products going to be ready anytime soon? And if not, when? Are you keeping a track on implementation? And when can I go buy pot in a store? That's what everyone wants to know from me. Yeah.
So the plan was, so as I said, so you had these multiple state agencies that are developing these regulations for medical, and now they're in charge, now they have the responsibility of doing this for the non-medical market. And it was just, a month or a month and a half ago that they finally released some of the regulations on the medical side.
Draft regulations.
Draft regulations. Not just the regulations, but the justifications. And, some of these documents are 300 pages. Encouraged by that. I mean, the agencies involved, you've got the Bureau of Cannabis. Well, it used to be the Bureau of Medical Marijuana Regulation.
Bummer.
So they changed it to the Bureau of Cannabis Marijuana or Medical Cannabis Regulation. I think eventually it's just going to be the Bureau of Cannabis Regulation. You've got them and then Department of Health and then some other agencies. And it looks like, they've been taking this pretty seriously in terms of thinking about how you're going to do the testing and labeling. And so regulations were just released like a month ago, and they're still looking for public comment. So I think they'll be done with public comment on that like on June 20th. So if you're really interested in this, you can read them and then kind of submit information on the web to them. And I guess they're planning that sometime at the end of the summer, they're going to release the regulations on the non-medical side. It'll be interesting to kind of see how different they are. I definitely could see this happening in 2018, but part of the story is what's happening at the state level. A lot's going to depend on the local jurisdictions too. You know, are they just going to kind of grandfather in those that are, you know, the medical dispensaries that they've already have licensed? And so, you're definitely going to see the stores, the recreational stores. I'd be shocked if you didn't see some of the recreational stores opening up in 2018. But it's going to be this long kind of process. And so, it's interesting kind of from a research perspective. You know, a lot of people are going to be like, what happens in California? Well, when do you say, if you're kind of doing the research, when did legalization start? Did it start when they gave out the first license in January? Or was it actually in 2016, right after Prop 64 passed, adult possession was legal? So that's one of the things that, you know, as a researcher, and we kind of see this on the medical marijuana side too, you know, when do people consider a law went into an effect? And so that's why, at least on the medical marijuana side, you'll see a lot of studies kind of all over the place with the results. And a lot actually depends on, well, how do you define when the policy changed? And I think you're going to see the same thing happening on the recreational side too. So at least for the next 5 years, you're going to see studies coming out all over the place.
It sounds like it's not going to be like a runner's gun start, bang, and like the doors fly open across California and people stream in, almost the way it was in Colorado on January 1st, 2014, where a number of recreation or medical stores got the license to go rec, and they could all open up on the same day, and it was like a big day. Like, it sounds like it might be a thing where one store in Berkeley gets a temporary rec license, and they do a little thing, and then another place in San Diego does one, and another invent. Like, it might be this really slow, scattered rollout of retail access.
I think that could be the case. And on top of all of this, so you've got the state trying to come up with these different regulations. Governor Brown introduced some legislation trying to actually, because you've got these two different systems, you've got medical and the non-medical. So he introduced, it was like a 79-page bill, trying to actually streamline the process. And so, and there were a number of different things that were kind of in that particular bill. Which could shape whether or not you actually have to get the local licenses there. And there's another thing which hasn't been getting a lot of attention, but I think it speaks to something that Emily mentioned earlier. With Proposition 64, what they initially were trying to do is trying to give a head start to some of the small and the medium grows. So what it meant is for the first 5 years, you could only get a license to produce for a small grow or a medium grow, where a medium grow was an acre outdoors or half acre indoors. And then there was another license category called large production, but you couldn't be, which was essentially unlimited, but you weren't going to be able to get those until 2023. So kind of giving a head start to the small and the medium grows. And what was passed in Prop 64 didn't put a limit on the number of grows that you could have. But in the bill that was kind of put forward by Governor Brown, they're actually suggesting putting a limit on the total number of medium grows.
Okay.
And so, I mean, it'll be interesting to see if this passes, because then it would kind of give the state a lot more control over production. And if they do that for the medium grows, it'd be interesting to see if they would actually do that then for the large grows. I mean, there's this other story, too, where the federal government, since this is all illegal, they could say, hey, we might be fine with the medical grow or with the middle grows, but come 2023, we're not going to allow the large grows. We'll shut them down. That's an option.
If you had to be a betting man, what would you bet $10 that the federal government's going to do in the next 2 or 3 years, if anything?
That's a really good question.
Emily, do you have any thoughts?
I don't know. I think we have a very unpredictable administration.
Yeah, it's been.
That's kind of their bag, right?
Yeah.
You don't know what we're going to do next.
Yeah. The thing is I find it very unlikely that you're going to see the DEA going out and shutting down all the retail establishments. The bottom line is the DEA only has about 4,000 to 5,000 agents. I mean, most drug arrests that happen in the United States are made by local and state officials. And so it would be difficult for the DEA to do this. And also, I mean, the optics. I mean, we're dealing with prescription opioids and heroin. So kind of taking DEA away from that to go shut down the facilities, I mean, there'll be blowback there. There'll also be a blowback in the states as well. While I find it unlikely that they would shut down, that the DEA is going to go physically shut down all the different retail establishments, they could still wreak havoc upon this industry. It'd be very easy for them to send out letters to landlords saying, a cease and desist letter. We know you're renting to a medical or to a marijuana business. This is illegal under federal law. You don't evict them in 30 days, we're going to seize your property. You could do that. Yeah.
But they tried that in California in 2011. All four U.S. attorneys declared a medical crackdown here in California. Forfeiture letters went out. Berkeley Patients Group down the road was targeted for forfeiture. Harborside in Oakland was targeted for forfeiture. Those dispensaries beat their cases and they were dismissed with prejudice, which means the federal government can't go after them for the same thing. And California went on to fully legalize it 5 years after that crackdown started.
Yeah.
So if history is any guide there,
Well, that's going to depend on What the, I mean, you could do the cease and desist letters. I mean, that's only one piece of this.
Yeah.
You could do that. I mean, the other thing is banking. I mean, banking is difficult right now. And in some of these places, you've got, you know, different credit unions popping up that are taking the money from these businesses. They're all violating federal law. You could actually go after some of those businesses.
Well, you could go after the regulators, too, for facilitating.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of conspiracy, yeah. But no, you raise a good point. A lot of this is going to depend on, as I said, I think the priorities of these U.S. attorneys. You know, the DEA isn't going to go make a bunch of...
Who don't exist right now.
Yeah. Well, they exist, but it's not, you know, it's kind of this...
No one's been...
Yeah, they're all acting directors. You know, because the DEA isn't going to go make a bunch of arrests if they know that the prosecutor's not going to go for the cases. And so I think a lot.
I've heard that U.S. attorneys have said, "Man, it is really hard to get a California jury to convict for weed anymore. They just don't take it." And now you can do, or you've always can do, jury nullification, which means the jury goes, "This shouldn't be a crime. We reject the whole premise of this case."
Yeah.
And we might see more of that. You guys have been a great crowd. Does anyone have any questions for our panelists? Boom, tie dye in the back. Shout.
Emerald Triangle. Do you think they have any advantage in the marketplace because they've been doing it for so long? Or is there enough literature on growing now that anybody could jump in and create an equally good product?
Great question.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. I think they have an advantage in the marketplace. There are some really excellent like horticulturalists up there, like breeders you know, people that can produce, I don't know, a 10-pound plant. That was one time. But there are some incredible, incredible farmers. I think in the marketplace, and I think people would really have historically loved their product. I think that the word marketplace is part of the problem. They don't have access to the legal market as much as they would like, and that's part of the problem. And I think, like, for instance, a character in my book, Mirror, like, a lot of people I know have been just sitting on their marijuana and are unable to sell it from last season. And so they have a ton of experience and, you know, horticultural wizardry, but they just, like, it's kind of fading out. They're either teaching their children and hoping that the kids can, like, keep it going, or, you know, their markets they're having a hard time selling to the dispensaries. And like something like Harborside, he's growing his own weed. And when I went with Marish, I think that he sold like 1 pound. She sold 1 pound to them. It's really hard for them to be part of the legal market. So I think there's a lot of skill, but they're having a hard time finding their place.
Bo, is there any differentiator Humboldt has in a post-legalization market, do you think?
I think there's in terms of branding.
Yeah, I would add to that. Like, people love to buy story now. It's not just a Cliff Bar. It's from this local company that has a good ethos and da 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 da. Everyone wants to buy the story of the product as much as the product. And Humboldt certainly has cornered the market on pot stories.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I totally agree, and like there is that brand. But what's interesting is like the people who are taking the Humboldt story are not the people that I'm like talking about that have been doing it for 40 or 50 years. It's like, you know, some guy from Rhode Island who's been there 10 years and like, you know, is a good talker. And
yeah. It strikes me that a lot of the skill set and benefits or advantages of being a black market grower in Humboldt don't translate to the white market. You're super far away from labor, capital, track and trace systems, business in general, and then you specialized at like not filling out forms, doing whatever you wanted, and answering to no one. And now this market's all about capital, labor, markets, regulations, public comment.
Marketing.
It's almost like, can the leopard change its spots? You know, and I guess maybe not. Maybe its kids might be born with a different set of spots.
You know, one of the... this woman in my book that I read about, she joined a collective that was working really hard to be like, to sell to the Whole Foods kind of customer. And they were like this artisanal boutique dispensary. called the Tea House Collective, and they, you know, the Tea House, and it sounded really great. They could not, and it was all these kind of like the old generation.
They were the first branding.
They were awesome, and they were like trying to like have a delivery service in Berkeley and San Francisco, and they just, it didn't work. It like felt, it was like, you know, weekly meetings for years, and they couldn't sell, you know, they all invested a pound of pot up front, and then they just like, it didn't sell enough. They couldn't like access this market here.
Yeah.
There weren't enough Whole Foods shoppers that knew about the Tea House pot and wanted to like have it delivered. So
I saw a bunch more hands, and we have 8 minutes, so we'll try to knock them out. That's 4 or 5 questions, so like a minute each. Front row.
Have state agencies taken any steps to inform people who are incarcerated for marijuana charges that they can now repeal those charges or go to court to get out of jail?
Bo.
Well, you wrote the story on this.
Yeah. It depends on the state agency in terms of city or county. And we are seeing cities and counties take proactive steps with regard to resentencing and record expungement. For example, in San Mateo County, they went through whoever they had in prison and said, oh, all these guys are in here just awaiting trial for a crime that if they were convicted, they've already served more time, so let those guys go. And that's happening in a number of cities and counties around the states. Some were slower to reorient to the new regime than others, but so for example, a lot of the coastal cities and counties were a little bit first, and now some of the inland ones are catching on. But they're definitely looking at who they got in jail and what cases are pending and see if they can clear those out because of Prop 64. And what's missing is a big public education campaign around people with a past record, normal everyday citizens who have a 20-year-old pot conviction who want to do something about it. I got a text message this morning from a buddy from college who's like, how do I do expungement? This is a 20-year-old thing. I just don't want it on my record anymore. He doesn't have to have it. He certainly doesn't feel like he knows the next steps to take. And I'm really excited to see groups filling the gap there. So there is an expungement clinic that's run out of a law school in San Diego now that meets every month. That's a perfect thing for law school kids to do, is like meet with like old black people and get their pot convictions off their records from like 60 years ago, pro bono, you know? And we're definitely gonna be covering more of that. And next question.
Before I ask my question, I'll just say I grew up in New York, and I never heard of Humboldt.
Well, you grew up where?
In New York.
Oh, yeah.
And I never heard of Humboldt until I was in my 20s, and I happened to meet some California friends. So I don't know that the brand really carries that far.
Yeah, it's not exactly Champagne, France yet.
Yeah.
Yet.
Second of all, I'm wondering where these dispensaries are getting their product, if not from the small farmers in Humboldt.
Emily?
I think probably depends on the dispensary, but in general, I think a lot of it is like indoor grown in the cities, right?
I believe so.
It's all over the state. I mean, so, we talk about Humboldt. There's a lot. I mean, there's been a long history of production there, but there's a lot of production in Oakland. There's production in San Francisco, all up and down, you know, the Central Coast, L.A.
With Prop 215, which was the medical initiative in 94, I mean, you just saw anybody with, like, anybody basically could get a medical recommendation and start growing a few plants or have somebody grow a few plants for them, and that just meant, like, you know, production went up all over the state and prices went a lot, like, they went down. And so also this is a whole thing, but in general, marijuana grown indoors under lights is more popular in the dispensaries, and that tends to be what people grow in urban environments. But it's just, I'm sure within a couple of blocks a year, people are growing pot.
Well, let me summarize. Like, if you go into BPG on San Pablo and you buy and you look at the bud behind the counter, you're going to see a mix of indoor grown and outdoor grown. And that's coming from their patient cultivators who are members of their collective legally under Proposition 215 and SB 420. So as members of that collective, they're both patients who are selling their excess into the collective. There's plenty of room for chicanery with that system. But and some of these medical people are growing it under the cover of medical and exporting. There's a lot of stuff going on. But in general, you're seeing small batch, pound, 2 pound, 10 pound, 5 pound bags coming into clubs from growers in this region and the surrounding regions who are doing it indoors and out as a medical patient. And that's what's selling right now. Third row back.
Thanks. I was just wondering if you could comment on the trimmigrant phenomenon, how that's going to change, because you have people coming from all over the world. How is legalization going to affect prices and that flow of migration?
Anybody got a trimmigrant spiel?
Yeah, so the trimmigrants, for anybody who doesn't know, these are like seasonal farm workers who kind of go up to Humboldt. And they're from all over the world. Maybe it's like Israelis traveling or Costa Ricans or somebody met in Chile or whatever. But they go up and they want to do the seasonal trimming work, which is the processing of the marijuana buds for market. And God, what's really interesting, I was talking to a friend, and there's recently, like, there's now, like, a marijuana workers' temp agency in Southern Humboldt.
There's trimmigrant like, temps.
Oh, right.
Yeah. You can hire a temp firm.
I mean, like, I was
send
like, that's
10
great.
Dudes down
like,
to your house.
Because it's often a problem.
Women, actually.
Like, you know, oh, who am I going to get? Do I get some random from the town square? And then there's always the fear of, like, you some people just come and, like, have little signs with pictures of scissors and hope some grower will pick them up. And then there's the fear that the grower might be some abuser. And then there's the fear of the growers that, you know, the trimmigrants are going to rip them off. And so, because it's all this murky gray area, but now there's going to be, people are going to have, if you're legal, have their workers like on the books. And I think it's going to change. I think prices are going to go down. Trimmigrants used to make
$200
a pound.
Yeah. Took them about
and
a day.
Good ones could do it in a day. It's, I don't know, it's pretty hard. Like, you have to, I don't know. I tried it once. It was like really very tedious. was not able to reach a pound. But it's, yeah, I think prices are going to go down, and I think you're going to see it more and more kind of industrialized with temp workers, and people are going to be on the books now. And as long as there's still a black market, you'll still probably have people.
Yeah, a mix of black market, both.
Yeah, also, and as long as it's federally legal, there'll be a black market.
And with the extracts, what we're seeing now, and so I just finished analyzing all the data for Washington State. So they have this this seed to sale system.
Track and trace.
It's amazing, the data.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean we're before we didn't have a lot of information
on
the
market.
Now I have information on 40 million transactions. It's unbelievable. And so right now the fastest growing segment of the market are the extracts, your oils and edibles. And there you can just grow, and then you can put them through machines, and it's just extracting out, not just from the buds, but also, you know, typically a plant, only about half of the THC is in the buds. The rest of the THC is in the plant. And so I think, especially if you allow large-scale industrialization, I think you're going to see more. My guess is you're going to continue to see that market increase with the different vape pens. And like I said, there will always be a market for kind of the hand-cut, purple-tinged, you know, different buds. Most of your heavy users are people that don't have a lot of money. And so they're not necessarily going to be the ones that are going to be purchased. I mean, we're kind of in this bubble here in the Bay Area where we have all these dispensaries. We have a lot of people and, you know, people choosing to get bud that's over 20% THC. But a colleague of mine had estimated that most of the marijuana consumed in the United States is by people with a high school education or less. People not necessarily making a tremendous amount of money. So they're going to be much more price sensitive. But I mean, there's always going to be the demand for some of the boutique stuff, but I think some of the cheaper stuff, especially some of the oils and the vape pens, I think that's going to continue to grow.
Yeah, I think trimmigrants with industrialization and machines mean that there's no job for them, which means that it's a boutique thing that, like, I want to buy bud, and it says right on there, organically grown, hand-trimmed by Mendocino, original third gen, you know, like, you can support that, but so much of it is going to be the Budweiser, and people are going to care about the cost, not how many hands touched it per se. When people talk about the state of cannabis, I would want them to take away that it's completely in flux, and then 5 years from now, 10 years from now, it's arguably going to be the inverse of the industry we know today, aside from the core molecules involved in getting, you know, the effects. Those are going to stay the same, but how they're grown, manufactured, distributed, it's all changing. Blue cowl hat.
Two questions. First one is, what good data is there on the tax revenue projections? Say it's the end of 2018 and we've had a full year. What is the speculation that how much tax revenue this is going to generate, given the consumption up to this point? And you brought up organic. Who is going to be the certifying agency on that?
Bo, do you want to take a crack at this?
In terms of the revenues, so last year, both in Colorado and Washington, they ended up bringing in right around $150 million in tax revenue. The Legislative Analyst Office here in California did a projection about what they thought the state could bring in once the market was up and running. And so they estimated it could be up to $1 billion in tax revenue per year, not the next year, but once things are up and running. And kind of looking at the numbers that they did, I kind of thought that's pretty realistic, what we've seen in Colorado and Washington. Now, will they always be able to bring in $1 billion? A lot's going to depend on what happens to the prices, what happens to, you know, at the federal level. But I think getting up to at least $1 billion in 5 years, I think that's completely reasonable.
The key thing to keep in mind about that billion, though, is that it's not that much. It might cover regulating and have some left over for schools or whatever, but the city and county of San Francisco's annual budget alone, $9 billion. So, it's people want to make this, the tax money's going to save something. The only thing that's going to save your schools is you. You know, pot can't save your schools. Your second question was organic. And did you want to take a crack at the organic
thing? I don't know if...
I do. So there's a Department of Pesticide Regulation in California. They're almost as big as the EPA. They probably are going to have a budget bigger than the EPA when Donald Trump's done with his budget. And they are very, very focused. They have a very big program around organic agriculture in California. We have an idea of what we define that as. We have criteria to apply that to cannabis, and that's in the works. And I talked to that guy, Brian, at the Department of Pesticide Regulation, and he said that it's going to be a slow process of turning up the heat on these growers with regard to pesticides and contaminants. They don't want to scare everybody out of the pool right off the bat. They want to like cook them like the frog in the pot a little. And you know, it's going to be fine at first, but every year they're going to be marching toward organic standards, and that's something consumers definitely want. I know we want to get there now. Okay, we're out of time. If you have any more questions, see us afterward. Green shirt in the back. We're signing books. Yeah, thank you so much for coming down.
Thank you,
Berry of Books Fest and Cornerstone and Emily Brady and Bo Kilmer and Berkeley. Have a great Sunday afternoon.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.